Examples of Dignity, Thoughts on the Work of José Saramago. A Composite of Examples of Dignity, Guardian, 2008, and My Introduction to the Electronic Edition of Saramago's Novels, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, 2010, along with Reviews of Seeing, Guardian, March 2006, and The Elephant's Journey, Guardian, July 2010. My friend, the poet Naomi Raplansky, wrote me that she was reading a great novel, Blindness, by José Saramago. I knew he had been awarded the 1998 Nobel Prize, but it was Naomi's judgment that moved me to trot out and buy a copy. I was a bit put off by the first page when I saw the eccentric punctuation. Saramago likes run-on sentences, eschews quotation marks, and is loath to paragraph. Punctuation seems to me one of the few human inventions without bad side effects, and I am so fond of all the little dots and curls that I once taught a whole writing course devoted to them. So a Saramago page, one dense thicket from top to bottom with only commas to indicate the path, was hard going for me, and I was inclined to resent it. And soon, as I pushed on through the thicket, I began to get scared. The story was, to put it mildly, a nightmare. Tough-minded thrillers I'd read were custard sauce to this. The idea of everybody in a city suddenly going blind, not all at once but at random, over several days, is fairly horrible in itself. Saramago's even, quiet narrative tone brings the horror home as he describes it through the eyes, all too literally, of one ordinary person after another. Despite or because of governmental efforts at control, the city soon begins to break down. Cars driven by blind drivers, fires in homes, panicky soldiers faced with panicky citizens. A disused mental hospital where the early blind are locked away very soon becomes a hellish concentration of the worst that terror and weakness can bring out in people. Bullying, enslavement, gratuitous cruelty, rape. At this point, I stopped reading the book. I couldn't handle it. To read on, to be willing to read about terrible cruelty, I had to trust the author unquestioningly, the way one trusts Primo Levi. I had to know that Saramago was not merely putting on a horror show, exploiting his power over his readers. I was quite ready to admit the power, his Dostoevskian gift for communicating suffering, but I needed to trust him enough to let him tell me this fearful story in the confidence that he'd make it worth enduring. The only way to find out if he deserved such trust was to read his other books. So I did. That is, I read all of them I could get in English. Saramago writes in Portuguese, his native language. Exploring his novels, I found out a little about the man himself. He tells us as much as he feels we need to know in his fine, honest, eloquent, reticent Nobel lecture. Born in 1922 to a peasant family, he went barefoot till he was 14. His maternal grandparents kept 6 pigs, their livelihood. On cold nights, they brought the weaker piglets into their bed. Poverty forced him out of college track schooling into trade school, and he worked some years as a mechanic before he could begin to follow his literary vocation. He writes in the Nobel lecture of Common People I Knew, deceived by a church both accomplice and beneficiary of the power of the state and of the landlords, people permanently watched by the police, people so many times innocent victims of the arbitrariness of a false justice. I haven't lost, not yet at least, the hope of meriting a little more the greatness of those examples of dignity proposed to me in the vast immensity of the plains of Alentejo. He became, and is, a communist. When he was 44, he published his first book of poetry. He wrote for various papers and published editorials and essays, and also worked for years as a translator, putting writers as various as Colette and Tolstoy into Portuguese. In the 1980s, in his 60s, he was able to turn his full energy to writing novels. The first of these, Baltazar and Blimunda, was an international success, and he hasn't had to look back since then. He has paid a price among some critics for his outspoken criticism of Israel's U.S.-backed policies, though critics often seem to ignore his politics, shrugging off the notion that anybody now could seriously hold to socialist principles. Indeed, it takes a man of intransigent character to do so, but he is not really a political novelist, and anything but preachy. His themes are complex, both earthy and elusive. My course of reading, The Late Ricardo Reis, also published as The Year of the Death of Ricardo Reis, The Stone Raft, The Cave, and several other books, of which more later, was entirely successful. I returned to blindness and began it again from the beginning, by now used to the thickets and confident that wherever Saramago took me, however hard the going, it would be worth it. Others may not find the book as frightening as I did. Too many novelists, like too many filmmakers, cram their stories with ruthless violence gloatingly described, seeking to violate a shock threshold that grows ever higher, using cruelty to sell their books, to thrill readers who have been trained to think that nothing is interesting but action, or to keep their own demons at bay by loosing them on other people. And too many realists, following the principle that if it isn't ugly, it can't be true, are as alert as fire wardens to make sure any glimpse of decency or gleam of hope is promptly extinguished. Siding more with Keats on this point, I generally avoid such fictions, hence both my liking for non-realist writers and my initial reluctance to trust Saramago's painfully ugly story. Those inured to fictional brutality and blood-spattered film screens will lack my squeamishness about horrors they take for granted. That is a pity, because they will not have the experience I had in finally reading Blindness straight through, which was of a genuinely miraculous rising up out of awful darkness into a clear, truthful light. I say miraculous, not intending to suggest any supernatural intervention. That's scarcely Saramago's line. He is generally polite about God, and his novel about Jesus is affectionate towards Jesus, though he judges Jehovah as a hanging judge should be judged. He looks for no help from heaven. In the dark story of Blindness, the thin glimmer of light is that of a solitary human soul trying to do the right thing. She can do right, protect her husband, only by doing wrong, by lying. She pretends to be blind like everybody else, but she is not, so she must witness unbearable horrors. Behind her dilemma stands the old cynical adage, "In the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king." H.G. Wells wrote one of his best and strangest tales to disprove it. Saramago develops the disproof yet further and makes of it as powerful a moral novel as has been written in the past 50 years. To me, it is almost unbearably moving, and the truest parable of the 20th century. It completely changed my idea of what literature, at this strange time of paralysis in crisis, can be and do. Saramago died in the summer of 2010 at 87. That fall, Houghton Mifflin Harcourt published an electronic edition of his novels, and it's fitting that they should have such an edition, a virtual presence, for it was Saramago who in one of his blog posts first spoke of virtual literature, a fiction that seems to have detached itself from reality in order better to reveal its invisible mysteries. He credits Jorge Luis Borges with the invention of this genre, but he himself brought to it the one quality of greatness that Borges's fictions lack, a passionate and compassionate interest in ordinary people and everyday human life. We probably don't really need any more categories, but virtual literature might be a useful one, differing from science fiction and speculative fiction with their extrapolative bent, fantasy with its wholly imagined realities, satire with its meliorative indignation, magic realism which is indigenous to South America, and modernist realism with its fixation on the banal. I see virtual literature sharing ground with all these genres, as indeed they all overlap, yet differing from them insofar as its aim is, as Saramago put it, the revelation of mystery. In his books, this is revelation of the most secular and unpretentious kind, no grand epiphanies, only a gathering and slow arrival of light, as in the hour before sunrise. The mystery revealed is that of daylight, of seeing the world clearly, the mystery that happens literally every day. Saramago wrote his first major novel when he was over 60 and finished his last, Cain, a little before he died. I have to go on speaking of him in the present tense. He lives so vividly in his writings, these works of a senior citizen, our patronizing euphemism for the dreaded words, old man. His extraordinary gifts of invention and narration, his radical intelligence, wit, humor, good sense, and goodness of heart will shine out to anyone who values such qualities in an artist, but his age gives his art a singular edge. He has news for us all, including old readers tired of hearing the young or the wannabe young telling us the stuff we used to tell everybody when we were young. Saramago has left all the heavy breathing decades behind him. He has grown up. Heresy, as it may seem to the cultists of youth, he is more than he was when he was young, more of a man, a person, an artist. He's been farther and learned more. He has seen most of the 20th century and has had time to think about it, decide what matters, and learn how to say it. The energy and mastery with which he says it is a marvel. He is the only novelist of my generation who tells me what I didn't know, or rather, what I didn't know I knew. The only one I still learn from. He had the time and the courage to earn that subtle and unpretentious kind of understanding we call inadequately, wisdom. But it's not the glib reassurance often labeled wisdom. He's anything but reassuring. Though he doesn't parrot the counsels of despair, he has little confidence in that kindly trickster, hope. Radical means of the root, and Saramago was a deeply rooted man. Accepting the Nobel Prize in a king's court, he spoke with passion and simplicity of his grandparents in the plains of the Alentejo. Peasants, very poor people, to him a lifelong beloved presence and moral example. His love for his native country is the motive force of his Journey to Portugal, the only nonfiction work in the electronic anthology. A detailed guidebook of travel through the land from north to south, it is also a voyage of discovery, of rediscovery, a journey back to the country from which he was self-exiled for years in protest against the religious bigotry of its government. He was radically conservative in the true meaning of the word, which has nothing to do with the reactionary quacking of the neocons, whom he despised. An atheist and socialist, he spoke out and suffered for, not mere beliefs or opinions, but rational convictions, formed on a clear ethical framework which could be reduced almost to a sentence, but a sentence of immensely complex political, social, and spiritual implication. It is wrong to hurt people weaker than you are. His international reputation has suffered most from his steadfast opposition to Israeli aggression against Palestine. His demand that Israel, remembering the suffering of the Jews, cease to inflict the same kind of suffering on their neighbors has cost him the approval of those who conflate opposition to Israel's aggressive policy with anti-Semitism. To him, religion doesn't enter into it. While Jewish history simply supports his argument, it is a matter of the powerful hurting those weaker than they are. Saramago, famously said, "God is the silence of the universe, and man is the cry that gives meaning to that silence." He isn't often so dramatically epigrammatic. I would describe his usual attitude to God as inquisitive, incredulous, humorous, and patient, about as far from the ranting professional atheist as you can get. Yet he is an atheist, anti-clerical and distrustful of religion, and the potentates of piety, of course, detest him, a dislike he cordially returns. In his fascinating notebook, blog posts from 2008 and 2009, he castigates the mufti of Saudi Arabia who, as he says, legalized pederasty by legalizing marriage for girls of 10, and the Pope of Rome, so reluctant to condemn pederasty among his priests, again a matter of the powerful hurting the defenseless. Saramago's atheism is of a piece with his feminism. His fierce outrage at the mistreatment, underpayment, and devaluing of women, the way men misuse the power over women given them by every society. And this is all of a piece with his socialism. He is on the side of the underdog. He is without sentimentality. In his understanding of people, Saramago brings us something very rare, a disillusion that allows affection and admiration, a clear-sighted forgiveness. He doesn't expect too much of us. He is perhaps closer in spirit and in humor to our first great European novelist, Cervantes, than any novelist since. When the dream of reason and the hope of justice are endlessly disappointed, cynicism is the easy out. But Saramago, the stubborn peasant, will not take the easy out. Of course, he was no peasant. He worked his way up from ancestral poverty and a job as a garage mechanic to become a cultivated intellectual and man of letters, an editor and journalist. For years a city dweller, he loved Lisbon, and he deals as an insider with the issues of urban and industrial life. Yet often in his novels he also looks on that life from a place outside the city, a place where people make their own living with their own hands. He offers no idyllic pastoral regression, but a realistic sense of where and how common people genuinely connect with what is left of our common world. The most visibly radical thing about his novels is the aforementioned punctuation. Like me, readers may be put off by his use of commas instead of periods and his refusal to paragraph, which makes the page a forbidding block of print, and the dialogue frequently a puzzle as to who is speaking. This is a radical regression, on the way back to the medieval manuscript with no spaces between the words. I don't know his reason for these idiosyncrasies. I learned to accept them, but without enthusiasm. His use of what teachers call comma fault, or run-on sentences, induces me to read too fast, so that I lose the shape of the sentences and the speech and pause rhythm of conversation. When I read him aloud, I have little difficulty, probably because it slows me down. Grant him that quirk, and his prose, which I know through his splendid translator, Margaret Joel Costa, is clear, cogent, lively, robust, perfectly suited to narrative. He wastes no words. He is a great storyteller. Again, try reading him aloud. And the stories he has to tell are not like any others. Here are some brief notes about them, reflections on my own process of learning how to read Saramago, an education by no means completed. Baltasar and Blimunda, published in Portugal in 1982, earned prompt acclaim in Europe. A wild historical fantasy, full of such unexpected and unpredictable elements as Domenico Scarlatti, plague, the Inquisition, a witch, and flying men, it is odd, charming, funny, teasing, and tells an endearing love story. To me, it seems a warm-up for the greater novels to come, but it made his reputation, and many hold it to be among his best. Of all his books, I have the most difficulty with The Year of the Death of Ricardo Reis. This is Saramago at his most intellectually Borgesian, and perhaps at his most Portuguese. It asks of the reader, if not some knowledge of its subjects, the writer Fernando Pessoa, Portuguese literary culture, the city of Lisbon, at least a fascination with masks, doubles, and assumed identities, a fascination Saramago certainly had and I almost entirely lack. A reader who shares that fascination will find this, and later the double, a treasure. Of his next book, in his Nobel speech, he says simply, in consequence of the Portuguese government censorship of the Gospel according to Jesus Christ, 1991, vetoing its presentation for the European Literary Prize under the pretext that the book was offensive to Catholics, my wife and I transferred our residence to the island of Lanzarote in the Canaries. Most men who leave their homeland in protest against tyrannical bigotry go off shouting, pointing their fingers, shaking their fists. He just transferred his residence. I confess that the subject of the book is not of the highest interest to me, but it is a subtle, kind, and quietly unsettling work, an outstanding addition to the long list of Jesus novels, which may begin, as the title of this one implies, with the Gospels themselves. The Stone Raft is science fiction, a lovely novel that had the very rare fortune of being turned into a lovely movie made in Spain. Europe cracks apart at the Pyrenees, and the Iberian Peninsula drifts wonderfully, cataclysmically, off past the Canary Islands towards America. Saramago takes full advantage of this opportunity to make fun of the impatient and impotent pomposity of governments and the media when faced with events beyond the scope of bureaucrats and pundits, and also to explore the responses of some obscure citizens, ordinary people, as we call them, to the same mysterious events. This one of his funniest books. And here also we find the first important Saramago dog. There is a dog in blindness, too. Nobody in the book has a name, and the dog is known only as the Dog of Tears. He is an unforgettable dog. There is, I believe, a dog in all of Saramago's best books. His dogs embody a deep, essential element of his stories. They do not tell us what it is, since they cannot speak. Their silence is part of their importance. I'm not sure why I tend to rank his novels with a dog in them higher than the ones without, but it may have something to do with his refusal to consider man as central in the scheme of things. The more people fixate on humanity, it sometimes seems, the less humane they are. I have learned, whenever I begin a new Saramago, to hope for the arrival of the dog. Next, he was in his 70s now, and writing a novel every year or two, comes The History of the Siege of Lisbon. The first time I read it, I liked it, but felt stupid and inadequate, because it is or appears to be about the founding event of Portuguese history, and I know no Portuguese history. I was reading too carelessly to realize that my ignorance made no difference at all. Rereading it, I found that, of course, everything you need to know is in the novel. The real history of what happened in the 12th century when the Christians besieged the Moors in Lisbon, and the virtual history that comes to be interwoven with it through the change of a single word, a no to a yes, a deliberate mistake introduced into a new history of the Siege of Lisbon by a proofreader in Lisbon in the 20th century, one Raimundo Silva, who wants to subvert the authority of historical truth. Raimundo is a simple common man, distinguished from the crowd only by believing that all things have their visible sides and their invisible ones, and that we will know nothing about them until we manage to see both. Raimundo, the proofreader, is the hero of the story, and the love story, and that alone was enough to win my heart. Immediately after this mellow and meditative tale came Blindness. Its Portuguese title is An Essay on Blindness. Soon after came The Tale of the Unknown Island, an endearing and witty fable, and soon after that, All the Names, perhaps the most Kafkaesque of his novels, with its satire of a monstrous bureaucracy. Comparing Saramago with Kafka is a tricky business, though. He is drier and gentler than Kafka, his anger deep and temperate. I can't imagine Saramago writing Metamorphosis any more than I can imagine Kafka writing a love story. And All the Names, with its unforgettable registry leading back into impenetrable darkness, and its protagonist, Signor José, a clerk driven to seek the person behind one of the innumerable names in the files of the registry, if not exactly a love story, is a story about love. After the journey to Portugal, mentioned above, Saramago wrote The Cave, which in some ways I like the best of all because I like the people in it so much. Saramago will tell us what the book is about, though when he wrote this in The Notebook, he wasn't talking about his novel, but about the world he saw in May 2009. Every day, species of plants and animals are disappearing, along with languages and professions. The rich always get richer, and the poor always get poorer. Ignorance is expanding in a truly terrifying manner. Nowadays, we have an acute crisis in the distribution of wealth. Mineral exploitation has reached diabolical proportions. Multinationals dominate the world. I don't know whether shadows or images are screening reality from us. Perhaps we could discuss the subject indefinitely. What is already clear is that we have lost our critical capacity to analyze what is happening in the world. We seem to be locked inside Plato's cave. We have jettisoned our responsibility for thought and action. We have turned ourselves into inert beings, incapable of the sense of outrage, the refusal to conform, the capacity to protest, that were such strong features of our recent past. We are reaching the end of a civilization, and I don't welcome its final trumpet. In my opinion, neoliberalism is a new form of totalitarianism disguised as democracy, of which it retains almost nothing but a semblance. The shopping mall is the symbol of our times, but there is still another miniature and fast-disappearing world, that of small industries and artisanry. This is the framework of The Cave, an extraordinarily rich dystopia that uses science-fictional extrapolation with great skill in the service of a subtle and complex philosophical meditation that is at the same time and above all a powerful novel of character. One of the principal characters is a dog. In 2004 came Seeing, which picks up the setting and some of the characters of blindness, but uses them in an entirely different way. Nobody could accuse Saramago of writing the same book over, or anything like the same book. It is a heavy-hitting political satire, very dark, far darker, paradoxically, in its end and implications, than blindness. In his Nobel speech, the author, calling himself The Apprentice, said this. The apprentice thought, we are blind. And he sat down and wrote Blindness to remind those who might read it that we pervert reason when we humiliate life, that human dignity is insulted every day by the powerful of our world, that the universal lie has replaced the plural truths, that man stopped respecting himself when he lost the respect due to his fellow creatures. It is, on the face of it, an odd description of blindness, for in that book it is powerless people who insult human dignity, ordinary people terrified at finding themselves and everyone else blind and out of control. Some behave with stupid, selfish brutality, sauve qui peut. Indeed, abandoning self-respect and human decency, like the men who take over the asylum and abuse its inmates. They are a microcosm of the corruption of power. But the truly powerful of our world don't even appear in blindness, while seeing is all about them, the perverters of reason, the universal liars. Very evidently, Saramago's novels are not simple parables. It would be rash to explain what all the people, but one, in the first book, were blind to, or what the citizens of seeing see. What's clear is that they're the same people in the same city a few years later. One book illuminates the other in ways I can only begin to glimpse. The story begins with those ordinary citizens who not so long ago regained their sight and their tranquil day-to-day life, doing something that seems quite unconnected with vision or lack of it. It's voting day, and 83% of them, after not going to the polls in the morning, go in the late afternoon and cast a blank ballot. We see the dismay of bureaucrats, the excitement of journalists, the hysteria of the government. The satire is at first quite funny, and I thought I was in for a light Voltairean tale. I was missing signals. Turning in a blank ballot is a signal unfamiliar to most Britons and Americans who aren't yet used to living under a government that has made voting totally meaningless. In a functioning democracy, one can consider not voting a lazy protest liable to play into the hands of the party in power, as when low labor turnout allowed Margaret Thatcher's re-elections and democratic apathy both elections of George W. Bush. It comes hard to me to admit that a vote is not in itself an act of power. I was at first quite blind to the point Saramago's non-voting voters are making, but I began to see it at last when the Minister of Defense announces that what the country is facing is terrorism. Other ministers oppose him, but he gets what he wants, a state of emergency. A bomb is exploded, by terrorists, of course, as the media report, killing quite a few people. An attempted evacuation of the 17% of voters who marked their ballots ends in failure because the government forgets to tell the troops blocking the roads to let the refugees through. The non-voters, the so-called terrorists, help the refugees carry home all they tried to take with them, the tea service, the silver platter, the painting, Grandpa. The humor is still tender, but the tone darkens, tension rises. Characters, individuals, begin to come to the fore, all nameless except for Constant, the dog of tears from blindness. A superintendent of police is sent into the city to find the woman who did not go blind when everyone else did 4 years ago, the suspected link between the plague of white blindness and the plague of blank ballots. The superintendent becomes our viewpoint and mediator. We begin to see as he begins to see. He brings us to the woman who did not go blind, the gentle light-bearer of the first book. But where that story began with an awful darkness slowly opening into light, this one goes right down into the dark. Seeing says more about the days we are living in than any novel I have read. By now, Saramago was well into his 80s, and not surprisingly chose to write a book about death, a subject an old man understands with an intimacy no young writer, no matter how many bulls he fights or airplanes he jumps from, can quite equal. The premise of Death with Interruptions, also published as Death at Intervals, is irresistible. Death, who isn't one person but many, each with a locality she's responsible for, bureaucracy, after all, is everywhere, gets sick of her job and takes a vacation from it. This is a major theme in Saramago, the humble employee who decides to do something just a little out of line, just this once. So in the region for which this particular death is responsible, nobody dies. For a time, it seemed that the genially morbid tale was going to bog down in recounting the paralytic idiocy of governmental rivalries and bureaucratic infighting, all too reminiscent of the American Congress. Then the dog showed up, and I knew everything was all right. With the dog would come people, real people, who would do brave, stupid, and unpredictable things. They would fall in love, have sex, play the cello, make mistakes. They would be Saramago characters. They would be foolishly, painfully, nobly, simply human, even if one of them, the only one with a name, was death. In 2010, very shortly after Saramago's death, The Elephant's Journey was published in English. It may be his most perfect work of art, as pure and true and indestructible as a Mozart aria or a folk song. History attests that in 1551, an elephant made the journey from Lisbon to Vienna, a present from King João III of Portugal to Archduke Maximilian of Austria. In the novel, Solomon the Elephant and his mahout, Subro, whom the Archduke renames with true Habsburg infelicity, Fritz, proceed through various landscapes at an unhurried pace, attended by various functionaries and military men, and meeting along the way with villagers and townsfolk who variously interpret the sudden enigma of an elephant entering their lives. And that's the story. It is extremely funny. Old Saramago writes with a masterfully light hand, and the humor is tender, a mockery so tempered by patience and pity that the sting is gone, though the wit remains vital. The passage that begins with a mahout discussing religion with the Portuguese captain is particularly endearing. Having explained that he is a Christian, more or less, Subro undertakes to tell the soldiers about Ganesh. "You obviously know a good deal about Hinduism," says the captain. "More or less, sir, more or less," says the mahout, and goes on to describe how the god Shiva cut off his son Ganesha's head and replaced it with an elephant's head. "Fairy tales," says a soldier, and the mahout says, "like the one about the man who, having died, rose on the third day." Peasants from the nearby village are listening with interest. They have agreed. "There's not much to an elephant, really. When you've walked round him once, you've seen all there is to see." But the religious discussion arouses them, and they go wake up their priest to inform him of the important news. "God is an elephant, father." The priest protests and promises to exorcise the elephant. "Together," he tells them, "we will fight for our holy religion, and just remember, the people united will never be defeated." The whole episode is a series of contained miracles of absurdity, quiet laughter rising out of a profound, resigned, affectionate wisdom. In his Nobel talk, Saramago said, "As I could not and did not aspire to venture beyond my little plot of cultivated land, all I had left was the possibility of digging down, underneath, towards the roots. My own, but also the world's, if I can be allowed such an immoderate ambition." That hard, patient digging is what gives so light and delightful a book as this its depth and weight. It is no mere fable, as the story of an elephant's journey through the follies and superstitions of 16th-century Europe might well be. It has no moral. There is no happy ending. Solomon will get to Vienna, yes, and then 2 years later he will die. But his footprints may remain across the reader's mind, deep, round impressions in the dirt, not leading to the Austrian imperial court or anywhere else yet known, but indicating, perhaps, a more permanently rewarding direction to be followed. Those tracks are now imprinted on electrons as well as in the dirt, on the page, in the mind. They are now in the vibrations in our computers, the symbols on our screens, as real and intangible as light itself, for all who will to see and read and follow. Saramago writes with wit, heartbreaking dignity, and the simplicity of a great artist in full control of his art. Let us listen to a true elder of our people, a man of tears, a man of wisdom.